Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, narrated by Simon Slater.
Twilight finds the king melancholy. Another day of regress in his campaign to be a married man again. He denies, of course, that he is married to the queen. Cromwell, he says, I need to find my way to ownership of those... He looks sidelong, not wishing to say what he means. I understand there are legal difficulties. I do not pretend to understand them. And before you begin, I do not want them explained. The Cardinal has endowed his Oxford College, as also the school at Ipswich, with land that will produce an income in perpetuity. Henry wants their silver and gold plate, their libraries, their yearly revenues, and the land that produces the revenues. And he does not see why he should not have what he wants. The wealth of 29 monasteries has gone into those foundations, suppressed by permission of the Pope, on condition that the proceeds were used for the colleges. But do you know, Henry says, I am beginning to care very little about the Pope and his permissions. It is early summer. The evenings are long and the grass, the air, scented. You would think that a man like Henry, on a night like this, could go to whichever bed he pleases. The court is full of eager women. But after this interview, he will walk in the garden with Lady Anne, her hand resting on his arm, deep in conversation. Then he will go to his empty bed, and she, one presumes, to hers. When the king asks him what he hears from the cardinal, he says that he misses the light of His Majesty's countenance, that preparations for his enthronement at York are in hand. Then why doesn't he get to York? It seems to me he delays and delays. Henry glares at him. I will say this for you. You stick by your man. I have never had anything from the cardinal other than kindness. Why would I not? And you have no other master, the king says. My Lord Suffolk asks me, where does the fellow spring from? I tell him there are Cromwells in Leicestershire, Northamptonshire, landed people, or once they were. I suppose you're from some unfortunate branch of that family. No. You may not know your own forebears. I shall ask the heralds to look into it. Your Majesty is kind, but they will have scant success. The king is exasperated. He is failing to take advantage of what is on offer, a pedigree, however meagre. My Lord Cardinal told me you were an orphan. He told me you were brought up in a monastery. Ah, that was one of his little stories. He told me little stories? Several expressions chase each other across the king's face. Annoyance, amusement, a wish to call back times past. I suppose you did. He told me that you had a loathing of those in the religious life. That was why he found you diligent in his work. That was not the reason. He looks up. May I speak? Oh, for God's sake, Henry cries. I wish someone would. He is startled. Then he understands. Henry wants a conversation on any topic. One that's nothing to do with love or hunting or war. Now that Wolsey's gone, there's not much scope for it, unless you want to talk to a priest of some stripe. And if you send for a priest, what does it come back to? To love, to Anne, to what you want and can't have. If you ask me about the monks, I speak from experience, not prejudice, and though I have no doubt that some foundations are well governed, my experience has been of waste and corruption. May I suggest to your Majesty that, if you wish to see a parade of the seven deadly sins, you do not organise a mask at court, but call without notice at a monastery? I have seen monks who live like great lords, on the offerings of poor people, who would rather buy a blessing than buy bread. And that is not Christian conduct. Nor do I take the monasteries to be the repositories of learning some believe they are. Was Grocyn a monk, or Colette, or Lineker, or any of the great scholars? They were university men. The monks take in children and use them as servants. They don't even teach them dog Latin. I don't grudge them some bodily comforts. It cannot always be lent. What I cannot stomach is hypocrisy, fraud, idleness. Their worn-out relics, their threadbare worship, and their lack of invention. When did anything good last come from a monastery? They do not invent. They only repeat. And what they repeat is corrupt. For hundreds of years the monks have held the pen, and what they have written is what we take to be our history. But I do not believe it really is. I believe they have suppressed the history they don't like, and written one that is favourable to Rome. Henry appears to look straight through him, to the wall behind. He waits. Henry says, "Dog holes, then?" He smiles. Henry says, "Our history, as you know, I am gathering evidence. Manuscripts, opinions, comparisons, with how matters are ordered in other countries. Perhaps you would consult with those learned gentlemen. Put a little direction into their efforts. Talk to Dr. Cranmer. He will tell you what is needed. I could make good use of the money that flows yearly to Rome. King Francois is richer by far than I am. I do not have a tenth of his subjects. He taxes them as he pleases. For my part, I must call Parliament. If I do not, there are riots," he adds bitterly. "And riots if I do." "Take no lessons from King Francois," he says. "He likes war too much and trade too little." Henry smiles faintly. "You do not think so, but to me that is the remit of a king. There is more tax to be raised when trade is good. And if taxes are resisted, there may be other ways." Henry nods. "Very well. Begin with the colleges. Sit down with my lawyers." Harry Norris is there to show him out of the king's private rooms. Not smiling for once, rather stern, he says, "I wouldn't be his tax collector." He thinks, "Are the most remarkable moments of my life to be spent under the scrutiny of Henry Norris? He killed his father's best men, Empsom, Dudley. Didn't the Cardinal get one of their houses?" A spider scuttles from under a stool and presents him with a fact. "Empson's house on Fleet Street, granted the 9th of October, the first year of this reign." "This glorious reign," Norris says, as if he were issuing a correction. Gregory is 15 as summer begins. He sits a horse beautifully, and there are good reports of his swordsmanship. His Greek, well, his Greek is where it was. But he has a problem. "People in Cambridge are laughing at my greyhounds." "Why?" The black dogs are a matched pair. They have curving muscled necks and dainty feet. They keep their eyes lowered, mild and demure, till they sight prey. "They say, why would you have dogs that people can't see at night? Only felons have dogs like that. They say I hunt in the forests against the law. They say I hunt badgers like a churl." "What do you want?" he asks. "White ones or some spots of colour?" "Either would be correct." "I'll take your black dogs." Not that he has time to go out, but Richard or Rafe will use them. "But what if people laugh?" "Really, Gregory," Joanne says, "this is your father. I assure you, no one will dare laugh." When the weather is too wet to hunt, Gregory sits poring over the golden legend. He likes the lives of the saints. "Some of these things are true," he says, "some not." He reads La Morte d'Arthur, and because it is the new edition, they crowd around him, looking over his shoulder at the title page. "Here beginneth the first book of the most noble and worthy prince, King Arthur, sometime King of Great Britain." In the forefront of the picture, two couples embrace. On a high-stepping horse is a man with a mad hat, made of coiled tubes like fat serpents. Alice says, "Sir, "Did you wear a hat like that when you were young?" And he says, "I had a different colour for each day in the week, but mine were bigger." Behind this man, a woman rides pillion. "Do you think this represents Lady Anne?" Gregory asks. "They say the king does not like to be parted from her, so he perches her up behind him like a farmer's wife." The woman has big eyes and looks sick from jolting. It might just be Anne. There is a small castle, not much taller than a man, with a plank for a drawbridge. The birds circling above look like flying daggers. Gregory says, "Our king takes his descent from this Arthur. He was never really dead, but waited in the forest biding his time, or possibly in a lake. He is several centuries old. Merlin is a wizard. He comes later. You will see. There are 21 chapters. If it keeps on raining, I mean to read them all. Some of these things are true, and some of them lies. But they are all good stories." When the king next calls him to court, he wants a message sent to Wolsey. A Breton merchant whose ship was seized by the English 8 years ago is complaining he has not had the compensation promised. No one can find the paperwork. It was the cardinal who handled the case. Will he remember it? "I'm sure he will," he says. "That will be the ship with powdered pearls for ballast, the hold packed with unicorn's horns." "God forbid," says Charles Brandon, but the king laughs and says, "That will be the one." "If the sums are in doubt, or indeed the whole case, may I look after it?" The king hesitates. "I'm not sure you have a locus standi in the matter." It is at this moment that Brandon, quite unexpectedly, gives him a testimonial. "Harry, let him. When this fellow has finished, the Breton will be paying you." Dukes revolve in their spheres. When they confer, it is not for pleasure in each other's society. They like to be surrounded by their own courts, by men who reflect them and are subservient to them. For pleasure, they are as likely to be found with a kennel man as another duke. So it is that he spends an amiable hour with Brandon, looking over the king's hounds. It is not yet the season for hunting the hart, so the running dogs are well fed in their kennels, their musical barking rising into the evening air, and the tracking dogs, silent, as they are trained to be, rise on their hind legs and watch, dripping saliva, the progress of their suppers. The kennel children are carrying baskets of bread and bones, buckets of offal, and basins of pig's blood pottage. Charles Brandon inhales, appreciative, like a dowager in a rose garden. A huntsman calls forward a favourite bitch, white, patched with chestnut, Barbada, 4 years old. He straddles her and pulls back her head to show her eyes, clouded with a fine film. He will hate to kill her, but he doubts she will be much use this season. He, Cromwell, cups the bitch's jaw in his hand. "You can draw off the membrane with a curved needle. I've seen it done. You need a steady hand and to be quick. She doesn't like it, but then she won't like to be blind." He runs his hand over her ribs, feels the panicked throb of her little animal heart. "The needle must be very fine, and just this length." He shows them between finger and thumb. "Let me talk to your smith." Suffolk looks sideways at him. "You're a useful sort of man." They walk away. The duke says, "Look here. The problem is my wife." He waits. "I've always wanted Henry to have what he wants. I've always been loyal to him, even when he was talking about cutting my head off because I'd married his sister. But now what am I to do? Catherine is the queen, surely. My wife was always a friend of hers. She's beginning to talk of, I don't know, I'd give my life for the queen, that sort of thing. And for Norfolk's niece to have precedence over my wife, who is queen of France, we can't live with it, you see?" He nods. "I see." "Besides," the Duke says, "I hear Wyatt is due back from Calais."
"Yes, and?"
"I wonder if I ought to tell him. Tell Henry, I mean, poor devil."
"My lord,
Leave it alone. The Duke lapses into what, in another man, you would call silent thought. Summer. The king is hunting. If he wants him, he has to chase him. And if he is sent for, he goes. Henry visits, on his summer progress, his friends in Wiltshire, in Sussex, in Kent, or stays at his own houses, or the ones he's taken from the cardinal. Sometimes, even now, the queen and her stout little person rides out with a bow when the king hunts within one of his great parks, or in some lord's park, where the deer are driven to the archers. Lady Anne rides too, on separate occasions, and enjoys the pursuit. But there is a season to leave the ladies at home, and ride into the forest with the trackers and the running hounds, to rise before dawn, when the light is clouded like a pearl, to consult with the huntsman, and then unharbour the chosen stag. You do not know where the chase will end, or when. Harry Norris says to him, laughing, "Your turn soon, Master Cromwell, if he continues to favour you as he does. A word of advice. As the day begins and you ride out, pick a ditch. Picture it in your mind. When he has worn out three good horses, when the horn is blowing for another chase, you will be dreaming of that ditch. You will imagine lying down in it. Dead leaves and cool ditch water will be all you desire." He looks at Norris, his charming self-deprecation. He thinks, "You were with my cardinal at Putney when he fell on his knees in the dirt. Did you offer the pictures in your head to the court, to the world, to the students of Gray's Inn? For if not you, then who?" In the forest you may find yourself lost without companions. You may come to a river which is not on a map. You may lose sight of your quarry and forget why you are there. You may meet a dwarf, or the living Christ, or an old enemy of yours, or a new enemy, one you do not know until you see his face appear between the rustling leaves and see the glint of his dagger. You may find a woman asleep in a bower of leaves. For a moment, before you don't recognize her, you will think she is someone you know. At Austin Friars, there is little chance to be alone, or alone with just one person. Every letter of the alphabet watches you. In the counting house there is young Thomas Avery, whom you are training up to take a grip on your private finances. Midway through the letters comes Marlinspike, strolling in the garden with his observant golden eyes. Towards the end of the alphabet comes Thomas Riothesley, pronounced Risley. He's a bright young man, 25 or so, and well-connected, son of York Herald, nephew to Garter King-at-Arms. In Wolsey's household he worked under your direction, then was carried away by Gardiner, as Master Secretary, to work for him. Now he is sometimes at court, sometimes at Austin Friars. He's Stephen Spy, the children say, Richard and Rafe. Master Risley is tall, with red-blonde hair, but without the propensity of others of that complexion, the king, let's say, to grow pink when gratified, or mottled when cross. He's always pale and cool, always his handsome self, always composed. At Trinity Hall, he was a great actor in the students' plays, and he has certain affectations, a consciousness of himself, of how he appears. They mimic him behind his back, Richard and Rafe, and say, "My name is Riothesley, but as I wish to spare you effort, you can call me Risley." They say he only complicates his name like that so he can come here and sign things and use up our ink. They say, you know Gardiner, he is too angry to use long names. Gardiner just calls him you. They are pleased with this joke, and for a while, every time Mr. W appears, they shout, "It's you!" "Have mercy," he says, "on Master Risley. Cambridge men should have our respect." He would like to ask them, Richard, Rafe, "Master Riothesley, call me Risley. Do I look like a murderer?" There is a boy who says I do. This year there has been no summer plague. Londoners give thanks on their knees. On St. John's Eve the bonfires burn all night. At dawn, white lilies are carried in from the fields. The city daughters with shivering fingers weave them into drooping wreaths to pin on the city's gates and on city doors. He thinks about that little girl like a white flower, the girl with Lady Anne, who manoeuvred herself around the door. It would have been easy to find out her name, except he didn't, because he was busy finding out secrets from Mary. Next time he sees her... But what's the use of thinking of it? She will come of some noble house. He had meant to write to Gregory and say, I've seen such a sweet girl. I will find out who she is, and if I steer our family adroitly in the next few years, perhaps you can marry her. He has not written this. In his present precarious situation, it would be about as useful as the letters Gregory used to write to him. Dear Father, I hope you are well. I hope your dog is well. And now, no more for lack of time. Lord Chancellor Moore says, Come and see me, and we'll talk about Wolsey's colleges. I feel sure the King will do something for the poor scholars. Do come. Come and see my roses before the heat spoils them. Come and see my new carpet. It is a muted grey day. When he arrives at Chelsea, Master Secretary's barge is tied up, the Tudor flag limp in the sultry air. Beyond the gatehouse, the red brick house, new built, offers its bright facade to the river. He strolls towards it through the mulberry trees. Standing in the porch under the honeysuckle, Stephen Gardiner. The grounds at Chelsea are full of small pet animals, and as he approaches, and his host greets him, he sees that the Chancellor of England is holding a lop-eared rabbit with snowy fur. It hangs peacefully in his hands, like ermine mittens. "Is your son-in-law Roper with us today?" Gardiner asks. "A pity. I hope to see him change his religion again. I wanted to witness it." "A garden tour," Moore offers. "I thought we might see him sit down a friend of Luther, as formerly he was, yet come back to the church by the time they bring in the currants and gooseberries." "Will Roper is now settled," Moore says, "in the faith of England and of Rome." He says, "It's not really a good year for soft fruit." Moore looks at him out of the tail of his eye. He smiles. He chats genially as he leads them into the house. Lolloping after them comes Henry Pattinson, a servant of Moore's, he sometimes calls his fool, and to whom he allows license. The man is a great brawler. Normally you take in a fool to protect him, but in Pattinson's case it's the rest of the world needs protection. Is he really simple? There's something sly in Moore. He enjoys embarrassing people. It would be like him to have a fool that wasn't. Pattinson's supposed to have fallen from a church steeple and hit his head. At his waist, he wears a knotted string which he sometimes says is his rosary. Sometimes he says it is a scourge. Sometimes he says it is the rope that should have saved him from his fall. Entering the house, you meet the family hanging up. You see them painted life-size before you meet them in the flesh. And Moore, conscious of the double effect it makes, pauses to let you survey them, to take them in. The favourite, Meg, sits at her father's feet with a book on her knee. Gathered loosely about the Lord Chancellor are his son John, his ward, Anne Cressacre, who is John's wife, Margaret Giggs, who is also his ward, his aged father, Sir John Moore, his daughters Cicely and Elizabeth. Pattinson, with goggle eyes, and his wife, Alice, with lowered head and wearing a cross at the edge of the picture. Master Holbein has grouped them under his gaze, and fixed them forever, as long as no moth consumes, no flame, or mould or blight. In real life, there is something fraying about their host, a suspicion of unravelling weave. Being at his leisure, he wears a simple wool gown. The new carpet, for their inspection, is stretched out on two trestle tables. The ground is not crimson, but a blush colour. Not rose madder, he thinks, but a red dye mixed with whey. "My Lord Cardinal liked Turkey carpets," he murmurs. "The Doge once sent him 60. The wool is soft wool from mountain sheep, but none of them were black sheep. Where the pattern is darkest, the surface has already a brittle feel from patchy dyeing, and with time and use it may flake away. He turns up the corner, runs his fingertips over the knots, counting them by the inch, in an easy, accustomed action. "This is the Giord's knot," he says, "but the pattern is from Pergamon. You see there, within the octagons, the eight-pointed star." He smooths down the corner and walks away from it, turns back and says, "There." He walks forward, puts a tender hand on the floor. The interruption in the weave, the lozenge slightly distorted, warped out of true. At worst, the carpet is two carpets pieced together. At best, it has been woven by the villagers Pattinson, or patched together last year by Venetian slaves in a backstreet workshop. To be sure, he needs to turn the whole thing over. His host says, "Not a goodbye." "It's beautiful," he says, not wanting to spoil his pleasure. "But next time," he thinks, "take me with you." His hand skims the surface, rich and soft. The flaw in the weave hardly matters. A Turkey carpet is not on oath. There are some people in this world who like everything squared up and precise, and there are those who will allow some drift at the margins. He is both these kinds of person. He would not allow, for example, a careless ambiguity in a lease, but instinct tells him that sometimes a contract need not be drawn too tight. Leases, writs, statutes, all are written to be read, and each person reads them by the light of self-interest. Moore says, "What do you think, gentlemen? Walk on it, or hang it on the wall?" "Walk on it." "Thomas, your luxurious tastes." And they laugh. You would think they were friends. They go out to the aviary. They stand deep in talk, while finches flit and sing. A small grandchild toddles in. A woman in an apron shadows him or her. The child points to the finches, makes sounds expressive of pleasure, flaps its arms. It eyes Stephen Gardiner. Its small mouth turns down. The nurse swoops in before tears ensue. "How must it be," he asks Stephen, "to have such effortless power over the young?" Stephen scowls. Moore takes him by the arm. "Now, about the colleges," he says. "I have spoken to the king, and Master Secretary here has done his best. Truly he has. The king may refound Cardinal College in his name, but for Ipswich I see no hope. After all, it is only, I'm sorry to say this, Thomas, but it is only the birthplace of a man now disgraced, and so has no special claim on us." "It is a shame for the scholars." "It is, of course. Shall we go into supper?" In Moore's great hall, the conversation is exclusively in Latin. Their Moore's wife, Alice, is their hostess, and does not have a word of it. It is their custom to read a passage of scripture by way of a grace.
"It is Meg's turn tonight," Moore says.
He's keen to show off his darling. She takes the book, kissing it. Over the interruptions of the fool, she reads in Greek. Gardiner sits with his eyes shut tight. He looks not holy, but exasperated. He watches Margaret. She's perhaps 25. She has a sleek, darting head like the head of the little fox which Moore says he has tamed. All the same, he keeps it in a cage for safety. The servants come in. It is Alice's eye they catch as they place the dishes. Here, madam, and here. The family in the picture don't need servants, of course. They exist just by themselves, floating against the wall. "Eat, eat," says Moore. "All except Alice, who will burst out of her corset."